Father in heaven, we thank you that by your grace you sustain us, that you watch over us in trials, that those trials that come from within and without, that you maintain us. We ask, O Lord, that you would make us good stewards as well as good ambassadors for the Lord Jesus Christ in this world. We ask, O Lord, that you bless this study and that you be with us now in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so I'm going to move this down a little because it's a little loud. So I'm just going to review quite quickly what we've gone over thus far. In the first week, we talked about what secularism was. We went over the Old Testament and New Testament definitions of the word secular. In the Old Testament, it meant the outside wall of the temple or a priest who had a job outside of the temple. In the New Testament, the word for secular means this age or this world. We also kind of looked through how secularism has changed over the years. And we did that using some various art pieces. The point that we try to drive home out of those art pieces and over how the word secularism has changed is the almost inability to imagine somebody being able to be an atheist in a medieval or early modern world. In times past, the idea that someone could even be an atheist was almost unthinkable. And we're going to talk a little bit about why that is. We also talked about modern secularism and the definition that we're using. And for those of you that haven't been here for this, the definition we're using is based on the work of a philosopher by the name of Charles Taylor, who has defined secularism as the fundamental contestability of belief. The fundamental contestability of belief. And what that means is that all belief, from materialistic atheism all the way through orthodox, confessional Calvinist Christianity, in the secular world is contestable. It's up for grabs. There is nothing that in our society is a fundamental belief. And going back to that medieval view, in the medieval world and the early modern world at the point of the Reformation, the idea of atheism or believing something other than a confessional Christianity, whether that's you confess Roman Catholic Christianity or Calvinist or Lutheran, was unthinkable. And in the modern world, that has changed. So what Taylor's telling us is that the idea of that there is any confession that is the standard by which our social world lives is fundamentally wrong, and that all faith, all belief is fundamentally contestable. We then went on and we talked about the foolishness of this world, how the world gives us opposing meanings between belief and unbelief. The world tells us that there's an on and off switch. It's either or. There is no gray area. And what that gives us is this concept that doubt is somehow bad. That doubt makes us somehow less Christian or less of a believer than someone else. So the modern world tells us that doubt is fundamentally, there's something wrong with it. You either believe or you don't. There is no gray area for the secular world. We also talked about how we're haunted in this world. That believing doesn't come easy, but at the same time, everyone kind of knows there's something missing in the secular world and in the church. There's that recognition. And lastly, we talked about disenchantment, that the kind of spiritual magical aspect of faith and belief has been discounted, and we're only supposed to believe in that which we can touch and feel. It's a materialistic view of the world. So there is no more idea of God creating the world out of nothing. The idea that God could part the Red Sea, that he could turn water into wine, that he could feed the thousands, that those ideas within the secular world are not acceptable because they're magical, they're mysterious, they're spiritual. They're not based on this idea of, and I introduced this phrase last week, efficient causality, that domino effect. You hit one domino and something else happens. That is the concept by which the secular world runs. They do not allow for a God who intervenes in the history of man. That is not allowed within the secular world. So, moving on to today, we get to reforming belief and this idea that the secular world is an accomplishment, that the modern secular society believes that what we have now is actually an accomplishment. It's funny because they view this as though this is the final effect of all of history as we get to this secular age. The problem is that is actually runs contradictory to the way they view the world, which is this, like we said, materialistic view. So they even bring some spiritualism into it. So, catching up with my notes. So, I'm going to introduce two words today, and I'd like some help in defining them. But the help I would like is we can only define them using two-syllable words, no more than two-syllable words. So this is going to be a little bit of an exercise for us. So the first word is deism. And I know some may be familiar with that word, some might not. And if I had my slides, I had a really, really cool graphic for deism. But can someone explain deism using only two-syllable words? No, anyone? Yes, sir.
God is a clockmaker.
Very good. God is a clockmaker.
I am.
Or how about God doesn't care? Does that work? It's kind of along the same lines as the clockmaker. He sets it up, he winds it up, he leaves it there, and he just doesn't care after that.
Hands off.
He's hands off. He's off doing his own thing. Sorry?
Removed.
Removed. So, deism. The next word is Pelagianism. Can someone give me a definition using two-syllable words for Pelagianism? Yes, sir. Man is good.
I can.
God needs our consent. Yes, those are two-syllable words. Legalism, yes. So, Pelagianism is this idea that we're going to do something, and deism is this idea that God doesn't really care. If we were to explain the morality of the secular world, we would write an equation. We would say deism plus Pelagianism equals modern morality. There is a God, but he doesn't care. We are fundamentally doing the work. That provides us what is moral. So this fundamental kind of, this secular fundamentalism presents this kind of secular version of agape love. Except it's not coming from our love of Christ produces in us love for other people. It's our striving forces us to love other people. So, understanding when we talked last week about the gospel of the cross versus the gospel of glory, what does deism plus Pelagianism equal? The gospel of glory. Secularism is, at its foundation, a gospel of glory which seeks its own glory, not the glory of Christ. And it says, I can do all things through myself whom I strengthen. That's fundamentally the morality of secularism. So secularism also does this interesting thing where it presents itself as this kind of cool, giant, rational age where everybody's kind of confident in what they're thinking and doing. There's a confidence in secularism, or at least they say there is. If you listen to people on television who are talking about secularism or secularism issues, they present them as being of course. This is true. Everybody agrees with it. Moving on. Right? That's how it's presented. But do we actually see in the secular world that sort of confidence actually lived out? And we've talked about that before, that there is something lacking. That fundamentally in the secular world, it recognizes that even though it's doing all of this striving for glory, that there's still something missing. And one of the examples, we were in the first class talking about secular funerals. And how if you go to a secular funeral, there's still these ghosts of Christianity, or even just generally at larger, ghosts of religion that exist within it. Mrs. Lynn gave the example of a funeral she went to for some non-believers, which was at a Catholic church. And even though somebody who did not believe in what the Catholic Church was teaching still felt that draw to go there for a funeral, they recognized that something had to be done at the end. I gave a couple examples of from friends of mine who are pastors who have done funerals for believers but whose children were unbelievers. And the children recognizing that they had to do this funeral. There was this kind of haunting that existed in looking at the problem of death that they had to do something. So even though the secular world likes to present itself as confident in their rationality and in the way that they present it, there is still something when presented with when presented with death that makes them reflective and seek out for something that isn't fundamentally rational, that isn't fundamentally based in their experience. They're reaching out. So, there has been kind of an explosion in our world of potential sources of meaning. So that haunting, like we've talked about, and you might notice that we're doing quite a bit of review here from the last 2 weeks before we move on into the next piece. There's all of these options. And the photo that I was going to use was actually of the metaphysics section at Barnes & Noble, which is actually sitting right next to the science section at Barnes & Noble. So here you have this spirituality mysticism section in a bookstore, and it's sitting right next to a science section, and yet you could have the same person pick up a book from the science section, which is ultimately rationalistic and looks at the world through the lens of science and rationalism and mathematics, and have the same person pick up a book out of the spiritualistic metaphysical section. You know, because they need to know which rocks they need to have in their living room so that they get powers. So that's the situation that the secular world has now created, where that sheer rationalism has produced a, to use the philosophical term, multiplicity of options for the secular man to select from. And it almost creates the possibility that you could be both scientifically rational, yet also at the same time be going to this spiritualistic section, because there's no judgment in the spiritualistic section. There's only, you know, snake oil. So this then leads to a, when you put all of these options together, it creates fragility. It makes people fragile. When presented with issues that have eternal consequence, when people are presented with issues that fundamentally question, kind of like Pastor was talking about today, they're presented with a challenge, with a crucible, and you have all of these options, and you have all of these possibilities, and you're told that everything is pretty much rationalistic, but then you're hit with something real in your life. What does that cause in the secular person? It's sheer chaos. Exactly. It's sheer chaos. Because if there are all of these options at the same time, yet I'm told that I'm supposed to be rationalistic in the way that I approach the world, and then, like in my case, my daughter is diagnosed with cancer, or in other cases, a parent dies, or a child dies, or a spouse dies, or you're faced with your own mortality in some way. Where does that person go? There's nothing. Because once you give somebody every option and you say all options are on the table, then no options are on the table. You have presented them really truly with nothing that they can hold on to. Nothing is solid. Everything becomes air. So we then get to, and I apologize as this is a bit stunted because I made the number one mistake of relying on my slides. I'm going to get in trouble after. Never rely on your slides. So, and this is actually a great quote. So I'm just going to read this straight through and then we'll kind of chat about it. Some of the best minds are cross-pressured between orthodoxy and unbelief, producing through the cross-pressure a multitude of third ways. With so many third ways, so many options like we were talking about, a malaise develops, buffering people from choices. We talked about this last week. Once you're presented with so many options, what's the default position is to select none. So you buffer yourself. And in doing so, you ultimately seal yourself off from enchantment. And when we say enchantment, we're talking about the way that the Christian world looks at the creation of the earth, the created order. That when believers look at things in the world, whether it's your children's fingers or the mountains or the seas, that there's an enchantment to it because we recognize the power of God in what we're looking at. But the second that you present somebody with multitude of options and then you tell them, oh, by the way, all options are on the table, the only choice they're left with is disenchantment, is to close that off and say that this world is just a cold, hard reality and there is no rhyme or reason to it. And in that way, they cosmically isolate themselves from a world that is enchanted, that God does work in. This is where we're leading to. Now, the reason that this is all important is because, as we talked about in the beginning, we have this philosophical bar fight that goes on in the hearts of the secular world, where you have the guy from down below that is punching at him. And that guy is the one that's saying that this world matters ultimately. Finally, this is the world that matters. So things like evolution, things like your physical body as opposed to your spiritual self, those are the things how much money you make. Are you living the right way? Meaning, do you have all your stuff together? That's what actually matters for that guy. That's the imminent part of the secular man. That's what he's getting hit in the face with every day. At the same time, and this is where we're going to be headed towards, you have that transcendent side, the big idea, that haunting, that he knows that there's something more in this world than just what he is seeing and experiencing. So you end up with people that go to funerals that don't believe, yet they want to have a Christian funeral. You end up with people who somehow think that rocks have power over them. You end up with people that think that, all roads lead to God, even though those roads contradict each other. So you've got this, you know, in that philosophical bar fight, you got the guy on top that's punching down, telling them there's something bigger, and the guy punching from below, telling them that this is what matters, and then you have all of these options that he can choose from. So where we're going with this is next week is, and then what I hope to give you kind of a taste of looking forward to that, is a sense that something's been lost, like I mentioned. So if something's been lost, then that assumption that the material world has the answer has to be false, right? If something's been lost that you had, then the answer that's given isn't providing the whole answer. And this is where we as the church have the ability to move outside and talk to the secular world. Because if in their hearts they recognize that something is lost, then we can tell them where to find it if it's explained properly. The problem is that when, and I know this will speak to some of your hearts, when you try to make Christianity look like the world, it ceases to become relevant to where the world is at. So what you end up with in a lot of modern evangelical churches is them actually presenting the gospel to look exactly like the thing that's causing them the trouble to begin with. So here you have somebody that fundamentally is looking at the world around them, going, something is lost. And then you have the church presenting them a worship service, a belief, a faith that says, oh, no, it's all okay. There's nothing lost. We're going to show you in the mirror exactly what you're looking for. And people don't want the mirror. Does that make sense? I mean, so we as the church then have to present them with something else. Now, one of the things that we'll talk about in a few weeks that Jamie Smith mentions in his book is that the historical rootedness of the Christian faith is one of the greatest attractors of the secular world. Now, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but one of the largest, as a percentage of total, growing denominations in the United States is the Greek Orthodox Church. The Roman Catholic Church in the United States has experienced a resurgence in the unchurched actually walking through the front door. One of the reasons is the faith that they present, as much as we in the Reformed world may disagree with it, is they present a faith that's rooted in history, that is unabashed in what it does, is not willing to change for anybody else, and is going to continue doing what it's doing. And that is attractive to the secular world. Why would that be attractive? There's an anchor. It's filling that hole, right? I mean, it's actually presenting the answer to the question that they're asking that the evangelical church is unwilling to answer. Because the evangelical church is trying to be the world to the world. Whereas the confessional churches, and I'm using that word in the broadest possible sense that I can use. And that's Lutherans, that's Anglicans, that's Reformed people. And you could even, because they do have a confession, throw Catholics and Orthodox in there. It's not the same confession, but they do have a confession. What they are presenting is a faith that's, irrespective of what the world says, is going to do its own thing. So the sense of something being lost actually ends up presenting an ability to share the gospel with the world and say, we believe something, here's why we believe it, and oh, by the way, we've been believing this for thousands of years, and we're not going to change, regardless of what you present us in your arguments. One of the term that actually Jamie Smith uses in the book for that feeling of something lost is a felt flatness, which is really interesting. You know, and you even see this in a lot of modern evangelical churches. There is a felt flatness to it. It's kind of vanilla. And what the secular world recognizes in themselves is that felt flatness at birth, at death, at marriage. There's something missing. He calls it a felt flatness. Another great example. If you take, and this is, I'm going to talk about a particular classical work. You take Bach has his Mass in B minor, or you take something like Mozart's Requiem, or you take Handel's Messiah. All of these things have to do with the gospel. All of these were effectively written to be sung in churches, some in Catholic, some in Protestant, but all of them are meant to be sung in churches. Where do we go to listen to them today? Sorry? The symphony. We take it out of its context. The secular world sheds off all of the religious connotations, and they want to appreciate something like Handel's Messiah, but they don't want to have to appreciate it with all of the baggage of having to go to church and sit there under the cross and listen to it. So we even see it in music, that we can detach it from its fundamental use and look at it sheerly for its materialistic use, which is to make us happy, you know, something to tickle our ears. But as far as that music being something that's wholly related to the worship of an eternal God, we're going to strip that away. We're going to move that out. We're going to put it in a symphony hall where it's been completely denuded of its religious implication. We do the same thing with art. In the medieval, early modern, and the Reformation era, art was linked to faith. And we saw that when we were looking at Rembrandt, when we were looking at Vermeer, when we looked at medieval paintings in the first class. Even when you look at Vermeer, who is not painting religious articles, and he's not painting a religious painting, his faith still affects it. His faith still affects the way that he perceives the world, which allows him to use art to portray something along the lines of the gospel. With modern art, it has completely stripped it away from the human experience. I mean, if most modern art that you look at is going to be completely stripped of the higher experiences, it is going to bring it down. It's not going to bring it up. So it's kind of almost the race for the bottom. And in the same way, kind of reflects that when we're talking about music, when we talk about Handel's Messiah, it's the same kind of idea. We're going to take art out of its context of having to do with the deepest strivings of man, and we're effectively just going to make it marketing and advertising, because that is the base level. Yes, sir.
And we were looking at worship music online, and there was different, I don't know what the term would be, but he selected one selection, and I immediately said, that's entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
He was, that's for worship.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, my view was that is entertainment music doesn't belong in the setting. So you're saying bringing the sacred into the outside secular world.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, many Christians are doing that. They're bringing the outside world entertainment.
Yeah,
and
that's clearly a case of
Right. Yeah. Right. And I guess we're in the from looking at worship, we kind of, I mean, it gets to this very delicate balance of exactly does mode actually mean something? You know, I mean, and there, I remember talking to a Pentecostal minister about this particular issue, and he proceeded to kind of spank me when he opened up a hymnal and he started showing me hymns where the actual tunes of them are based on beer drinking songs from the 17th century. And he's like, so my music isn't okay, but you can use a pub tune from the 16th, 17th century. Some of it is, but there are a couple. There's a couple. And the same argument, I think, and I'm not saying that it's that I disagree. I just haven't thought about it enough to follow my sword. Cause I mean, we could even probably go back, you know, and talk to people at the early modern era as the Reformation's happening and find quite a bit of discontinuity between what they're thinking. It's an interesting topic though, but I think you could definitely see it in the construction, say, even of a facility. That if you could actually take a facility and use it for its unintended purpose and you can't tell, that's telling. So, like for instance, in The Hague, in the Netherlands, the old church, had effectively stopped being used for worship services at the end of World War II. Well, at the beginning of World War II, all worship there stopped. When the war was over, there were no churches that could afford to maintain it, so the government took it over and started renting it out as a hall. So what ends up happening now is actually yearly there's a pornography convention that's held inside the old church, which is this massive building, in The Hague. Yet it's done for a reason, because people recognize what they're doing by holding a pornography convention in a church. I mean, it's very much a thoughtful act. So, but you can recognize that in a church building. But then if we were to look at, you know, pick your name, Flowing Rivers Community Church with 20,000 members or whatever, and you've got a bunch of seats, you've got a big projector screen and a stage, we could take everybody out at the end of Sunday, Monday morning, set up a get-rich-quick convention, and nobody would be able to tell the difference. I mean,
That's the whole point, you know, in the sense of, as well as Christians going out into the world and making the gospel look like the world, we're making the church look like the secular world.
Correct.
In order to try to bring the people in.
Correct.
So we put in coffee shops, we put in basketball courts, we put in projectors, we put in, you know, and we, you know, we just make a whole production out of it in order to say to them, look, we're just like you.
Right, which is fundamentally what Smith is saying they don't want. Right. Fundamentally, they don't want to be told we're like them.
Right.
They want to walk in and see that it's completely different.
They want to see
They want to see holy other. That when they walk into church, this is completely different than all my experience.
But that's not what we're being communicated to. It's not the message that we receive as the average day Christian. The average day Christian hears it needs, you need to be relevant. I need to stick with that word, relevant.
But who tells us that we need to be relevant?
Well, I would take the church as the relevant church.
I know, right? They think we should be relevant.
Right. And I think the media. And I think it's that perhaps it's if you hear a lie often enough, it becomes looking like truth. That because what you're saying resonates with me. I believe that with all my heart. That we. That the world wants to see that we're different, but then I hear enough of the message that you know. Well, I hear people argue with me that I should be watching more television so that I'm relevant. I should be able to hear. here I should be relevant because I'm not relevant if I don't watch. I can't even remember the names of the
So is it possible that it could be actually a question of form versus substance? So it, as an example, if we look at the way that the world looks at secular world looks at science, you can talk to people and they will tell you, oh, I believe in science. I'm a fully rational thinker. Never mind the fact that this person has never taken a physics class in their entire life or can't do the math, but they are going to stand firm on the fact that science is correct, even though they don't know the science. So, right, because but they enjoy the form because it looks adult, it looks grown up. So when you walk into into our church and we're doing communion, somebody from the outside would look at it and go, it's bread and wine and grape juice. You know, kind of grow up. You know, what are you doing? The form is, they question the form. So what I would wonder is, when we're talking about being relevant, if it's not really a question of actually being relevant, but the form. You look relevant. We don't actually need you to be relevant, but you're going to present the implication is that I'm kind of cool, I'm with it, and I got it going on. So obviously I'm relevant. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. When the chip hits the floor, people who want to be responsible.
Right. Like the sermon this morning.
I think another point is, too, is when the point was brought up about relevancy, and you said, well, who says we need to be relevant? In my experience, I've discovered that the people that shout the loudest about you Christians need to be more relevant mm-hmm. have absolutely no intention of accepting anything about the Christian life and faith, but that's an easy way for them to shut it down and move on.
It's a subtraction story.
It subtracts and then...
Right, so what we're going to do...
Because you're not relevant.
Right, we're going to continue to subtract and subtract and subtract until nothing is actually demanded. Right?
It can also be the dog that tells itself sometimes. You know, the dog that gets itself sometimes, or the dog that shouts the loudest is the one that gets itself sometimes. So sometimes you say, you don't like that because we sense so much that what we're coming to is justice.
Right. Right. So, I'm going to try and sum up now what we've been talking about so far before we start going into this the big idea question and what are people doing by the draw to religion. Where we stand at this point is people knowing there's something greater, being told that if they think so, they're being immature, they're being kind of silly and sentimental, but yet people are under pressure by the world around them to actually figure out why I'm having these feelings. Why do I understand at the same time that I'm supposed to be a materialist, that I'm supposed to only care about this world, that I need to have all my stuff together, yet I know that there's something greater. I've got this haunting feeling that there's something more. Our job in the church, when it's addressing this issue, is to point out that drive down to materialism is discounting fear, and it's discounting unbelief and questions. Where what the world is doing is presenting the gospel of glory to people and saying that if you have fundamental questions, if you have disbelief, then you're not wholly on board and you're really just being sentimental about a church era that's long gone. And the gospel that the church need to be bringing forward is trouble with belief, misbelief, unbelief is normal. Because every single person in the pew deals with it. Every single person deals with belief issues at some point or another. And we as the church understand that. We have a history going back thousands of years of people who have struggled with belief, and we are going to go forward continuing to struggle with belief. But that's the world that we live in. The outside world believes in a universe where it's either or, and they are fundamentally supposed to only care about cause and effect, about getting my stuff together, and about the fact that this is the only thing that matters. But yet most people, when the chips are down, when they're in the crucible, recognize there's something else. And that leads to the problem. That's where the problem lies. Because now they've been told that unbelief is unacceptable, but yet they're not sure where they stand on it. And at that point, that's where the gospel message, the story of the cross, the gospel of the cross, comes to the fore. Because at that point we can say it's nothing that you have done, your misbelief has nothing to, or unbelief has nothing to do with the fact that Christ's permanent and total sacrifice has already paid for the sins that you have. That's where we actually, in the secular world, can present the gospel at that point of mis or disbelief. So, next week, hopefully, Lord willing, I want to discuss that draw to the divine, that big question, the big idea, the transcendent, and how the secular world deals with that. Hopefully that I can figure out. Well, hopefully next week I bring the adapter that I'm supposed to, so you can actually see the slides. Hopefully I don't rely on my slides next week in case there's a problem. I do have one, the Mac adapter. Yeah, I have a Mac adapter, unfortunately. I just assumed it was in my backpack. It wasn't. Yeah, no, I don't have it. It's not there. So, let's close with prayer. Father in heaven, we come before you and ask you to fill our hearts and our minds. We ask you, Lord, that in moments of dis and unbelief, that you would remind us of your presence, that you would give us a heart for those outside the church who are struggling with unbelief, that struggle with the conflict that they're presented in the secular world, that you would give us a heart for them, that you would put the words on our lips to give them comfort, that we would correctly present the gospel to them, and that we might be salt and light in the world. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen.